Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And we do have Paul back as we really, that was probably the best if you're talking about showmanship or professionalism or what have you. Saw it. We had the 8 seconds. We just went out like, you know, like professionals.
Yeah.
And so anyway.
We did not get, right. We didn't get surprised this time.
Yeah.
Right?
And that, it just happens, folks. And I would much rather, I really care more about the content than, you know, the, you know, it's nice to have things just work out perfectly, but, you know, we're just jamming as much as we possibly can. This radio show, there's no doubt in my mind, you know, you could metaphorically refer to this show as a fire hose. And, you know, from when we start to when we close, we're fire hosing you with content and information to basically, you know, get you all the information to give you the opportunity to actually make the right and best decisions. And we believe that reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree, that you will agree with us that there is only one path forward. And we've not gotten on that path, or I should say the majority of America has not gotten on that path. We're, right. You know, the majority of the good people in America are actually in the wrong camp. They're in the divisive camp of their myopic issues of conservatism. And conservatism will never step back away from the Constitution, which is why people need to realize that these groups, you know, whether it be, you know, they're self-serving groups. I like picking on the John Birch Society, but they're not the only ones. Almost all of them are that way. Tactical Civics. These are decent groups. And we even point out the party itself. I mean, there are very few parties, you know, yours in Missouri being one that actually standing up on the Constitution. I have the Wyoming Republican Party, but it's still factionalized. So anyway, united we stand, folks, divided we fall. And until we shift to the Constitution and away from this ambiguous conservative cloud, you know, and whatever myopic agendas that are, you know, factionalizing that, we need to do something, and we need to do something quick. But anyhow.
One of the things that I tell my audiences when I speak to them is that I'm not a conservative. You don't make points on defense. And by nature, the term conservative sounds like you're just holding back. You know, what are we conserving?
That's
you
right.
know, and so as we get, as conservatives get dragged through the mud, you know, then, you know, their heels conserve where they, you know, we're conserving where their heels get stuck in the mud. It's time to shuck that. It's time to let that go. Right. You know, we need to advance the cause of liberty, and we need to make, you don't make points in defense. What we're doing here is this is where we're going on offense. We're using the Constitution, right?
Right. And as a matter of fact, I like the adage, the best defense is what?
A good offense.
There you go. And so, folks, I mean, the truth is out there. And when you really start aligning and laying out these adages, these standard sayings that has just been accepted, you know, why is it that people, you know, can't see these things and go, you know what, that's true. This organization is strictly reactive to that instead of actually taking going on attack. It's defending. You're absolutely right. So anyway, so we're in the throes still of the ratification debates, and we are, let me see here. Well, we just kind of ended up with Mr. Iredell, amendments, common law, and all of that. And I added the common law comments. Right. So we're now on the Bill of Rights and Enumerated Powers. And so there's some big sections here that are highlighted. And actually, this is one of the standard citations that I actually use regarding the Bill of Rights and the enumerations of a concept or the concept of a limited power of attorney versus a general power of attorney. We heard Mr. McLean use the reference to an estate. Now we're actually going to hear this power of attorney brought up. So
I guess this is Mr. Aradell still,
yes,
right?
Yes, it is. He, yes.
Go ahead. All right, here we go. Bill of Rights, enumerated powers. With regard to a Bill of Rights, this is a notion originating in England, where no written constitution is to be found, and the authority of their governments derived from the most remote antiquity. Magna Carta itself is no constitution, but a solemn instrument ascertaining certain rights of individuals by the legislature for the time being, and every article of which the legislature may at any time alter. This, and a Bill of Rights also, the invention of later times, were occasioned by great usurpations of the crown, contrary, as was conceived, to the principles of their government, about which there was a variety of opinions. But neither that instrument nor any other instrument ever attempted to abridge the authority of Parliament, which is supposed to be without any limitation whatever. Had their constitution been fixed and certain, a Bill of Rights would have been useless, for the constitution would have shown plainly the extent of that authority which they were disputing about. Of what use, therefore, can a Bill of Rights be in this constitution, where the people express, where the people expressly declare how much power they do give, and consequently retain all they do not? It is a declaration of particular powers by the people to their representatives for particular purposes. It may be considered as great as a great power of attorney, under which no power can be exercised but what is expressly given. Did any man ever hear before that at the end of a power of attorney, it was said that the attorney should not exercise more power than was there given him? Suppose, for instance, a man had lands in the counties of Anson and Caswell, and he should give another a power of attorney to sell his lands in Anson. Would the other have any authority to sell the lands in Caswell? Or could he, without absurdity, say, 'Tis true you have not expressly authorized me to sell the lands in Caswell, but as you had lands there and did not say I should not, I thought I might as well sell those lands as of the other.'" End quote. A Bill of Rights, as I conceive, would not only be incongruous, but dangerous. No man, let his ingenuity be what it will, could enumerate all the individual rights not relinquished by this Constitution. Suppose, therefore, an enumeration of a great many, but an omission of some, and that long after all traces of our present disputes were at an end, any of the omitted rights should be invaded and the invasion be complained of, what would be the plausible answer of the government to such a complaint? Would they not naturally say, we live at a great distance from the time when this Constitution was established. We can judge of it much better by the ideas of it entertained at the time than by any ideas of our own. The Bill of Rights passed at that time showed that people did not think every power retained, which was not given, else this Bill of Rights was not only useless, but absurd. But we are not at liberty to charge an absurdity upon our ancestors, who have given such strong proofs of their good sense as well as their attachment to liberty. So long as the rights enumerated in the Bill of Rights remain unviolated, you have no reason to complain. This is not one of them. End quote. Thus, a Bill of Rights might operate as a snare rather than a protection. If we had formed a general legislature with undefined powers, a Bill of Rights would not only have been proper, but necessary, and it would have then operated as an exception to the legislative authority in such particulars. It has this effect in respect to some of the American constitutions where the powers of legislation are general, but where they are powers of a particular nature and expressly defined, as in the case of the Constitution before us, I think, for the reasons I have given, a Bill of Rights is not only unnecessary, but would be absurd and dangerous.
Interesting. Now he kind of, all these people that have been, talking about the necessity of the Bill of Rights and everything else. And actually, Let me give a good case in point, because, you know, we include the Bill of Rights against the federal government, and we include in some states the Bill of Rights at the state level. But quickly, we have learned that entities, government, are entities underneath the government, under entities controlled by government, are now invoking direct violations of the Constitution as an agent for government. Now, I'm going to get into the details of this. I'm kind of leaving this really ambiguous, but what business formed in the United States, in any state in this union, what business formed is not an agent under that government?
So if a business forms under the authority of a government, it must be the agent of that government.
Right, because that government then regulates such business. Now,
and then it must be subject to the jurisdiction thereof, right?
Well, it's correct. And see, here's the point, is that how many times do we believe businesses are private entities? Well, did they need approval to form? Do they need approval to operate?
Well, they do.
Yeah, they do. And so when can they create their own law and their own government?
They can create their own internal rules, I believe.
Yes.
They should be consistent.
Okay, so if an employee feels harmed by a business or by an employer, do they go to the business court and, you know, pursue justice?
No. They go to a state or a federal court.
Which is why the 14th Amendment clearly states that no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges and immunities. So in other words, these businesses as entities underneath the state are making policies, rules, and so forth of governing themselves that actually violate the privileges and immunities of U.S. citizens. So if you kind of start connecting the dots here, then you'll kind of see, you know, wow, okay, so that's not covered in the Bill of Rights. It's covered under the 14th Amendment, though.
Mm-hmm.
Because the Bill of Rights was strictly originally, and it was the intent behind the Bill of Rights, is it was to constrain the federal government. These weren't applied to the states, and many states do not have a Bill of Rights or these types of protections, which is why the necessity of the 14th Amendment to basically whap, backhand the states and say, you can't take advantage of U.S. citizens anymore. And we understand the cause of that, because that's exactly what the southern states were doing. They wanted to deny the privileges and immunities of the freemen. And at that point in time, it was them. Today, it's conservatives. It's constitutionalists. It's patriots. It's good people.
It's Christians.
It's Christians. I mean, they're abridging the privileges and immunities of U.S. Christian in schools and what have you. I mean, so when you really start thinking about it, folks, you know, the importance of the Bill of Rights really didn't happen until after we finally got rid of slavery and it begged the necessity of applying the Bill of Rights. So, okay, so it's not in there regarding the regulations of corporations. Now, what is a protection that is not directly derived underneath the Bill of Rights today that we absolutely need, that actually should be there? And, you know, some of those things really need to be defined, because these guys didn't define it. They couldn't imagine elections just being the way they are. I believe that making all elections local is a fundamental Bill of Rights.
Mm-hmm.
That I believe that anybody outside the election area that throws money into your county, your city, or your state election from California, from a foreign state or a foreign county in your own state, is undue influence and a violation of our Republican form of government. And they ought to be severely punished. And that's not in the Bill of Rights. Making all elections local, keeping the federal government out of our elections. Because if we allow them the power to regulate us, then they can mandate the outcome, because that's where they're going. And by the way, folks, I have in my possession this bill that the Republicans are trying to go move forward that is a spinoff of the leftist bill of the federal government seizing control. Now, I've told you before that it takes two parties to advance tyranny. It doesn't matter if it is a leftist bill or a conservative bill of elections. It is still surrendering control to the federal government. You better start realizing that that is never good. That the less
we... What is this bill?
It's over election integrity and so forth. As a matter of fact, let me see if I've got it open. I think I might still have it open here. So... the bill that I have, and I can get to it, it is 169 pages, and it's titled, I'll give you the long title, to promote election integrity, voter confidence, and faith in elections by removing federal impediments to providing state tools for and establishing voluntary considerations to support effective state administration. In other words, opening up the door for the federal government to come in of federal elections and improving election administration in the District of Columbia, improving the effectiveness of military voting, and protecting political speech and for other purposes. And every time they throw this protection this way, it will backfire on you. Every time. So why? Why would we want to actually allow them more jurisdiction? They're, the only thing that they have a dog to fight on are the four issues of the amendments provided. The issue of a person cannot be denied the right to vote because of race. The only jurisdiction regarding an election that they have regarding voting is regarding race, gender, age, and or poll taxes. States cannot put poll taxes out for people to obtain access to voting. So that's it. When it comes down to the federal elections, it is dictated within the Constitution very, very specific things. That the state legislature establishes the date, time, and manner of the elections, and specifically, Congress can actually come in and provide regulations for those elections. However, when we read Article 2 of the Constitution, you'll find that only the state legislatures have the authority to establish the date, time, and manner. There is no clause in there that allows Congress to actually provide regulations and laws if the states don't do that. In other words, this is very specific for the election of senators and representatives in that every other off-season year, you know, the off year of a presidential election, Congress can actually intervene in the time, manner, and place. However, they cannot in a presidential election.
Can you give me that bill number? That was a really long title. I wasn't able to find it, but I would like to reference that.
Well, actually, better than that, I can email it to you. But
okay.
This is being floated out, and this is actually coming out to roundtables, out to the Republican Party, trying to get the Republican Party to support this. And folks, the Republican Party, if they even hold this and they look at this, you know, and accept this, because they're the lapdogs. I mean, you know, when Congress comes out and they say, oh, we've got the solution, the Republican Party is just a lapdog for these agendas. Because I was talking to a Republican leader regarding this in the state of Washington, and I said, look, do you realize that every time you give them an inch, they take a mile? Why would you give them this inch? I know we have voter integrity problems, but that's not the solution. The solution is getting rid of public servants that don't hold their oath accountable so that they can actually start making laws that are in pursuant to the Constitution instead of allowing this insurrection over our elections and every other thing to continue. It's a, anyway, so we have the process, we have the ability to do these, to do what's right, but we don't gravitate that way. We gravitate to, yeah, let's fix the problem by doing this, giving Congress more power. That always causes more problems than fixes. Always. I mean, let's look at the history, because I'm working on the medical freedom petition. I'm almost done. And, you know, it started, folks, this injection into health and disease started in the 1800s. And it was of noble intent. But it didn't matter. They had no authority to do this. And by 1921, they created the Child's Health Bureau, the CHB. And they started growing and growing. Then they created Medicare. Or actually, they created Social Security. And in 65, they created Medicare. This concept. Oh, by the way, guess what state? What state dominated the bill and the concept of cradle-to-grave benefits?
Was it California?
Montana.
What?
Yes. It's in this petition. It's something Dingell bill. And just when I read that out loud, when I said the name of this act, that something Dingell act, I go, wow, you couldn't buy such irony.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
Let's just go ahead and move forward. I've done a pretty long intro,
man,
here on this.
We've been at this, and okay.
Okay, so the next one is Mr. Davey.
This is Mr. Davey.
Right, and this is the next day, July 29th. So okay. Go ahead.
All right.
And hold it. We have 2 minutes left. So go ahead and read comfortably to, you know, and I'll interject.
Go ahead. All right. This is jurisdiction and Mr. Davey. It is necessary in all governments, but particularly in a federal government, that its judiciary should be competent to the decision of all questions arising out of the Constitution. If I understand the gentleman right, his objection was not to the defined jurisdiction, but to the general jurisdiction, which is expressed thus, quote, the judicial power shall extend to all cases in law and equity arising under this Constitution, the laws of the United States, and treaties made or which shall be made under their authority, end quote. And also the appellate jurisdiction in some instances. Every member who has read the Constitution with attention must observe that there are certain fundamental principles in it, both of a positive and negative nature, which, being intended for the general advantage of the community, ought not to be violated by any future legislation of the particular states. Every member will agree that the positive regulations ought to be carried into execution and that the negative restrictions ought not to be disregarded or violated.
Okay, so I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So this is probably a good time because we got about less than a minute left. And so he's kind of, you know, highlighting again, and this is over the judiciary. Remember, we've actually covered the judiciary, the concerns over the judiciary out of all the different states, and they really are dogging this because there are a lot of lawyers involved in North Carolina and a lot of common law lawyers. And so this is, you know, very insightful, and they really point to some really good things. This is how I deduced, you know, this Republican form of government in the judiciary. So with that, when we come back, we'll kind of finish this off because this goes for a little while here. This is actually, you know, a page over to continue. So, folks, we're going to be right back. Paul will be right back after this short one promo that we've got. So when we actually get this and we get out to break, so I think, yep, here we go. Perfect timing. So with that, folks, we are going to be right back with more reading of the North Carolina debates by Paul. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Thank you so much.
To set the record straight, Republic Review is neither an Article 5 convention nor a convention of states. In accordance with Article 5 of the Constitution, this convention requires two-thirds of the states to apply to Congress to convene a convention with the intent to amend the Constitution. This convention is unable to solve our real problem, which is non-compliance to the Constitution, and would be dangerous to convene at this time. In contrast, Republic Review is the process of the states exerting its constitutional authority over the Constitution. An audit does not require an application to Congress. This authority is inherent to principal stakeholders of a contract. Why do we need Republic Review? Because this is the only way the states can deal with the federal encroachments into roles, responsibilities, and powers that belong to the states. To learn more about Republic Review, please go to reclaimingtherepublic.org to read my content and my model on the audit and Republic Review process. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, all right, so we gracefully went out on that break, and without any further rude interruptions, or at least for the next 20-plus minutes, go ahead and pick back up, Paul. Appreciate it.
Okay. Oh, without a judiciary, the injunctions of the Constitution may be disobeyed, and the positive regulations neglected or contravened. There are certain prohibitory provisions in this Constitution, the wisdom and propriety of which must strike every reflecting mind, and certainly meet with the warmest approbation of every citizen of this state. It provides, quote, that no state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any imposts or duties on imports or exports except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws, that no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the parts of one state over those ports of one state over those of another, and that no state shall admit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts, pass any bill of attainder ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts, end quote. These restrictions ought to supersede the laws of particular states. With respect to the prohibitory provision that no duty or impost shall be laid by any particular state, which is so highly in favor of us and the other non-importing states, the importing states might make laws laying duties, notwithstanding the Constitution might be violated with impunity if there were no power in the general government to correct and counteract such laws.
So let me ask you a question. What does he mean there by non-importing states?
So, non-importing. So, there are states that may be able to provide for their own needs, and they don't need to import goods from other states that produce it. So, let's say, for example, you had more industry in the north, the eastern states, and so they might be producing. You know, I don't know because
okay,
now
so,
that I think of it, the southern states were exporting as well.
Well, okay? so they were exporting, but see,
right?
When it came to importing products from the other mm-hmm. states, actually these agricultural states from Virginia down didn't do hardly any importation. I mean, they weren't necessarily buying because the factory production at this point in time really hadn't come online out of the New England states okay. and so forth. They were starting to move that way. But most importations, and what he's saying here is with respect to the prohibitory provision that no duty or impost shall be laid by any particular state. In other words, it was forbidden. No state could actually add a tax on the imports coming from another state, which is so highly in favor of us because they exported a lot of their product, you know, up to the manufacturing of making, you know, the clothes and so forth, right? So as they looked at this, they said, hey, this really favors us. Now, given, you know, as we talked yesterday, given the, you know, turn of events with Van Buren and everything else, they ended up, the northern states actually started putting imposts, or actually the federal government started putting some tariffs that actually went against the southern states. And it was fundamentally economic warfare that the federal government and the northern states started waging, which forced the issue of the Civil War. Go ahead.
So that's, you know, I had heard that recently. Okay. So what the northern states did was unconstitutional against the southern states.
Yeah, if you look up the
abomination, they were poking them in the eye for slavery.
Right, correct. And John C. Calhoun labeled these tariffs as the abominable tariffs. So if you kind of look at John C. Calhoun and tariffs, you'll find out, you know, this quotation or this term, like the you know, the stamp acts and the abominable acts. Well, they called these tariffs the abominable tariffs. And this was literally hurting the southern states economically. And they
go ahead.
The federal government exceeded the spirit and the law of the Constitution.
Right.
Right.
So the federal government and the northern states acted unconstitutionally. Now, because there are some arguments out there that it wasn't about slavery, it was about the abominable tax. However, it seems to me, from we've been reading and discussing, that, you know, the northern states, the abolitionist states, were just so disgusted with it that they just would do whatever they could to poke the southern states in the eye. And the other thing is, you pointed out that the Missouri Compromise probably exacerbated this situation.
Yeah. Yep. So by the concept of, you know, the civil government and the law that we had, there's no doubt that the states that seceded, the first thing they pointed to was slavery, and that stark contrast of how they chose to execute labor in their state, in contrast to the abolition states, that, you know, it became a moral issue. And the framers knew this. I mean, this really was stated during the Constitutional Convention by Mason. But that being that what it is, when they seceded under the principle of slavery. And what they should have done was they should have not even made that the issue, because acknowledging that it was up front made it, you know, it almost, you know, dirtied their hands, because bottom line, any state can secede from the Union if they truly feel and they point to violations of the Constitution. And so, you know, because I've talked about this with other people, and it kind of comes down this pike of, can California secede from the Union if all of a sudden, you know, and some of these other really progressive states that are, you know, so hell-bent on becoming communist states and moving America towards communism and embracing all of these things that are antithetical to the Constitution, can they secede from the Union if the Republic actually starts abiding and enforcing the, you know, adherence to the Constitution to the federal government? In other words, we start invoking Republic review and demanding full compliance of the federal government. Can the states at that point say, hey, hold it, you've got to give us this welfare, you've got to give us this money, and if you don't, we're leaving? Well, that money is unconstitutional. The only reason that they have a legitimate ability to secede from the Union, it isn't a willy-nilly thing. It is when the compact is being violated. And when we actually obtain compliance of the compact, and they say, we want to go that way, they've opened themselves to actually allow the government to come in and say, you can't secede. I'm not supporting Lincoln's concept. States can secede. They can secede. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, when a state secedes, it's just like divorce. You step away from your family, you know, regardless of who the parent is that steps away in a divorce, whether it be the man or the woman, and whoever is left with the cognizant, you know, authority over the home and the children, whoever's left, whoever stepped out, you don't have any say over those children anymore.
So So
you have no say over the Constitution of the federal government. You've divorced yourself from that.
Right.
Right.
So is it possible, though, okay, since the abominable tax was not constitutional, that the North forced this fight?
Yes. Yes.
Probably deliberately.
Yes, they did. And so what should have happened? I've said this so many times before. What should have happened was they should have seceded over the real constitutional things that the North basically was, you know, being too aggressive in punishing the South for their slavery. And you know what? Because bottom line, this is where Lincoln should have stood. Lincoln should have stood up and said, you know, you have the right to secede, instead of being the tyrant that he was. What he should have done, because I could call him an idiot, and I could be a armchair quarterback, you know, and saying I'm smarter than him. But bottom line, we have this thing called the Monroe Doctrine, that we're not going to allow any insidious intervention and or policies in the Western Hemisphere to exist that would be antithetical to liberty and what we're trying to do here in this hemisphere. And so he could have invoked the Monroe Doctrine to say we are going to eradicate slavery because we consider it a threat to liberty, and that, you know, if you have a slave state, you could easily come across the boundaries, seize people, and use them as slaves and enslave them. And we are going to eradicate that practice. And then, therefore, we would have actually started a civil war over slavery instead of over all of the wrong principles.
So here's another question. I think this is fairly unknown. Weren't there some international intrigues involved in the Civil War that a lot of people, I think, aren't aware of?
Britain was the big one. So Britain was the big one because it was stuck in their craw that they lost to us, and that they had every intent to try to undermine our liberty and undermine our nation. So that what they did was they, you know, went and they tried to get these southern states to become more indebted to them. And to be honest, the southern states didn't need that much help because they were winning all the war. Mm-hmm. What ended up happening, and see, this would have expedited everything had Lincoln actually did the right thing. Then it would have expedited the real war. We would have started kicking butt because when it became about slavery, we didn't lose. And I believe God blessed us in so many different ways. But bottom line, it would have really hastened their need to actually, you know, draw upon, you know, foreign states to fund them and give them, you know, I mean, where did they get this submarine that they had, this metal submarine? The Civil War, the South was the first to have that type of ship, you know, a submersible metal ship. Where did they get
didn't
that
Didn't they develop
from?
It?
I'm thinking that, well, the money and that type of stuff had to come from Britain. And there's no doubt that there were British, you know, envoys that were working with them and helping them. They may have developed it, but there's no doubt in my mind. I think Britain was a part of that. And, you know, all of the stuff that they were doing. Britain was rubbing their grubby mitts saying, we got America now. And when they ended up losing, boy, they were fit to be tied. And then with the 14th Amendment, that just sent them over the edge. The 14th Amendment basically declaring that Britain was not going to get any money from the United States, and that it was illegal to, you know, to charge any state for the debt of that, which basically implied that the faster the southern states accepted and ratified the 14th Amendment, they would be protected from this foreign debt. Which absolutely infuriated Britain, because it was in a way, it was an undermining. It was kind of like an ex post facto law. You know, you created a legitimate contract, and then you said that contract's illegal. Well, actually, the United States had the power to do that. There was nothing Britain could do, but it did infuriate them. And this is what really caused the envoy that was in the South, additional envoys to actually bring in enough people that with the South and the northern states with this targeting of the radical Republicans, they took control of Congress in 1870, which basically the outcome of that was the 1871, because, you know, 1870 was the election. So 1871 was the first session under this, you know, I'll call it the Radical Britain Congress. And that's when they created the Organic Act. And it was a direct violation of the Constitution. They assumed powers and authority in that act that they did not possess. And so all of these sovereigns and all these people out there that call themselves patriots, that think they're doing the right thing by claiming that the United States is a legitimate, abomination. It is not an abomination, but it's not legitimate. We the people have failed, and that's why I keep on saying this. It is our fault for not holding our public servants accountable at every level. And as soon as we start
getting... We have the tools to do that.
We have the tools to do it. So what's holding you up, folks? When are you going to be a part of the solution? Okay, so, enough eye poking, and we got 12 minutes. So go ahead and just dive into this. Keep going.
Okay.
This great object.
I think I left off this great object.
Yes.
Is that where I left?
Yep.
Okay. This great object can only be safely and completely obtained by the instrumentality of the federal judiciary. Would not Virginia, who has raised many thousand... Sorry, Chair.
It's okay.
I thought I had turned that off. Would not Virginia, who has raised many thousand pounds out of our citizens by her imposts, will avail herself of the same advantage if there were no constitutional power to counteract her regulations? If cases arising under the Constitution were left to her own courts, might she not still continue the same practices?
You know, but so that really shines the light on the cabal and why the cabal of Virginia, because they were getting rich off the other states.
Mm-hmm.
Why there was such a fervent fight over trying to keep, because, folks, money is the corrupter. Go ahead. Keep going.
Okay. If cases arising under the Constitution were left to her own courts, might she not still continue the same practices? But we are now to look for justice to the controlling power of the judiciary of the United States. If the Virginians were to continue to oppress us by laying duties, we can be relieved by a recurrence to the general judiciary. This restriction in the Constitution is a fundamental principle which is not to be violated, but which would have been a dead letter were there no judiciary constituted to enforce obedience to it. Paper money and private contracts were in the same condition. Without a general controlling judiciary, laws might be made in particular states to enable its citizens to defraud the citizens of other states. Is it probable if a citizen of South Carolina owed a sum of money to a citizen of this state that the latter would be certain of recovering the full value in their courts? That state might in future, as they have already done, make Pine Barren acts to discharge their debts. I'm not sure what he means by that, unless he means...
Well, so, they come up with these jargons and so forth. And to me, that's jargon of the time that they understood. You'd actually have to, do the research in that type of thing to find out what the heck does he mean by, this Pine Barren. So anyway.
Okay. All right, I'll go on. They might say that our citizens should be paid in sterile, inarable lands at an extravagant price. They might pass the most iniquitous installment laws, procrastinating the payment of debts due from their citizens for years, nay, for ages. Is it probable that we should get justice from their own judiciary, who might consider themselves obliged to obey the laws of their own state? Where, then, are we to look for justice?
That actually proves my point, that when we actually have judiciaries from each state, that, we should be able to expect that the judiciary would hold tightly the jurisdiction of the federal government and ensure that all things left to the states are left to the states and out of the federal courts.
Okay.
Okay.
Nope. All right. Let's see. Where then are we to look for justice?
Right.
To the judiciary of the United States. Gentlemen must have observed the contracted and narrow-minded regulations of the individual states and their predominant disposition to advance the interests of their own citizens to the prejudice of others. Will not these evils be continued if there be no restraint? The people of the United States have one common interest. They are all members of the same community and ought to have justice administered to them equally in every part of the continent, in the same manner, with the same dispatch, and on the same principles. It is therefore absolutely necessary that the judiciary of the Union should have jurisdiction in all cases arising in law and equity under the Constitution. Surely there should be somewhere a constitutional authority for carrying into execution constitutional provisions. Otherwise, as I have already said, they would be a dead letter. All right. You've got something here by still Mr. Davey yep. about interposition.
Right. It's the continuation on. The dead letter, and then with respect of their having jurisdiction. Keep going. This is about interposition. Right.
All right. With respect to their having jurisdiction of all cases arising under the laws of the United States, although I have a very high respect for the gentleman, I heard his objection to it with surprise. I thought if there were any political axiom under the sun, it must be that the judicial power ought to be coextensive with the legislative. The federal government ought to possess the means of carrying the laws into execution. This position will not be disputed. A government would be a fellow de se, put the execution of its laws under the control of another body. If laws are not to be carried into execution by the interposition of the judiciary, how is it to be done?
Right. And so interposition being the force. And so let's look at the Civil War, where Taney, Justice Taney, basically ruled that, you know, Abraham Lincoln was violating the Constitution. What did Abraham Lincoln tell him? By suspending the right of habeas corpus and imprisoning people, he said, you can't do that. So what did Abraham Lincoln respond to the Supreme Court justice?
I'm not sure, unless he said, you can't enforce it.
Yes, let me see you enforce that.
I thought that was something Jackson said.
Nope, that was actually Abraham. Abraham Lincoln told that to the Supreme Court justice when he was violating and actually imprisoning political prisoners in the Union.
Interesting. Yeah, that's why I hesitated, because I thought it was Jackson who had said that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, so moving on down.
Okay. So I was looking up this word. You know, it said a government would be a fellow de se to put in execution of its laws under the control of another body. And I looked up that term, which is Latin, and it means a person who commits suicide or who dies from the effects of having committed an unlawful malicious act or an act of deliberate self-destruction.
Uh-huh.
So it would be, he's describing the absurdity, okay, of a government putting itself under the execution of its laws under the control of another body. Anyway.
Right, right. There's another expression for that, a pyrrhus victory.
Yes, yes. I've heard that term, P-Y-R-H-H-U-S or something like
that. Yeah. What it means is a victory that came at such a cost that you're destroyed too.
Right. Okay. We are at paper money and Bill of Rights.
And 4 minutes. Right? Just go ahead and let's read this first paragraph, and then we'll go into the second paragraph and see if we can do it. I think we can do both, but go ahead.
I think so, too. The security of impartiality is the principal reason for giving up the ultimate decision of controversies between citizens of different states. It is essential to the interest of agriculture and commerce that the hands of the state should be bound from making paper money, installment laws, or pine barren acts. By such iniquitous laws, the merchant or farmer may be defrauded of a considerable part of his just claims. But in the federal court, real money will be recovered with that speed which is necessary to accommodate the circumstances of individuals. The tedious delays of judicial proceedings at present in some states are ruinous to creditors. In Virginia, Many suits are 20 or 30 years spun out by legal ingenuity and the defective construction of their judiciary. A citizen of Massachusetts or this country might be ruined before he could recover a debt in that state. It is necessary, therefore, in order to obtain justice, that we recur to the judiciary of the United States, where justice must be equally administered and where debt may be recovered from the citizen of one state as soon as from the citizen of another. As to a Bill of Rights, which has been brought forward in a manner I cannot account for, it is unnecessary to say anything. The learned gentleman has said that by a concurrent jurisdiction, the laws of the United States must necessarily clash with the law of the individual states, in consequence of which the laws of the states will be obstructed and the state governments absorbed. This cannot be the case. There's not one instance of a power given to the United States whereby the internal policy or administration of the states is affected. There is no instance that can be pointed out wherein the internal policy of the state can be affected by the judiciary of the United States. He mentioned impost laws. It has been given up on all hands that if there was a necessity of a federal court, it was on this account. Money is difficult to be got into the treasury. The power of the Treasury to enforce the federal laws is necessary to facilitate the collection of the public revenues. It is well known in this state with what reluctance and backwardness collectors pay up the public monies. We have been making laws after laws to remedy this evil and still find them ineffectual. Is it not, therefore, necessary to enable the general government to compel the delinquent receivers to be punctual? The honorable gentleman admits that the general government ought to legislate upon individuals instead of states. Okay.
There we go. And we got about a minute and a half left, so we can kind of gracefully bow out for the week. As I look forward to how much more we have from this, I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8... there's a whole bunch coming up on religion. I think that's where they cover the Mohammedans and all of that. And so, we probably got another 2 weeks, folks. So, I know that everybody is really, I get a lot of feedback, positive feedback regarding, you know, what we're doing here. And so I know that people will start jonesing for this type of content when we're no longer doing this because, you know, one thing that you gain when you learn is, you know, is absolute treasure. It is the intelligence and the knowledge, because it is that we draw from to exert power. It, you know, right?
Right.
Intelligence is power, or that, you know, that knowledge is power, what have you. So anyway, I appreciate your contributions. 10 seconds left. Anything?
Thanks, GR. I'm looking forward to next time.
Okay.
And if I have any questions, I'll let you know. Send me that email.
You bet. Next week it is. And folks, as you can tell, we cover a lot of stuff. But every part of this gives you all of the insights to help you really understand how well-defined and how limited this federal government really is on that Constitution. And it is that awakening that helps everybody, you know, work together in taking back our power. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.